The polar bear heads south. That's our main topic on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. As Pete Alonso is no longer a New York Met, he is a Baltimore Oriole. We talk about what that means for both franchises. And should the Mets just fold and no longer exist? We'll also fly around the league and do a very special edition of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugla. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Proud to say that the polar bears have been saved. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and no longer is Pete Alonso drifting out on an ice floe aimlessly through a cold sea. That berg of ice has washed up in Baltimore Harbor alongside $155 million.
Oh, it's Friday. We're home from the winter meetings, and we got quite the signing to talk about. Let's get right into it. It's our opener.
Pete Alonso's on the Orioles.
How about that? You're going to, I believe you will be there later today when Pete Alonso is introduced as the newest number 25 for the Baltimore Orioles. Of course, 20 is former number, retired in Baltimore because of Frank Robinson. So we will see what Pete Alonso has to say about joining the Baltimore Orioles, what Scott Boras has to say about finding Pete Alonso the deal he has been looking for quite some time. But this is a huge deal for the birds. And I think we should start with Baltimore because we've spent the last week laughing at the Mets. And we will have a Mets segment here for sure. But let's focus on the team that signed the player and now gets to have that player play for them and hit a bunch of home runs. Because the Orioles have been building up to something like this in theory. However, it is interesting that their first big move is a hitter. I think that there is something quite funny and interesting that this Mike Elias era has in large part been defined by homegrown bats. And we will talk about some of those homegrown bats as we assess what Pete Alonso does for this lineup. But that the Orioles would be in position to make a big free agent signing and for it to not be a pitcher. Now, it still might be a pitcher. We can get to that a little bit later. But to bring in Pete Alonso with a five-year, $155 million deal, one, it's just awesome because, like, good for Pete. And as you'll hear over the next 5 to 10 minutes, like, I love Pete. I think he's underrated. I think he's exactly the kind of player that really any team could use. But for the Orioles to be a hitter is something, right? Their first big move a year or two ago was to trade for Corbin Burns. But in this case, this is a heck of an investment that we have not seen in Baltimore for quite some time.
So I'll start super big picture, which is I am happy that big free agents are not just going to Mets, Dodgers, Yankees, Phillies, Blue Jays.
Feels good, right? Man.
That feels good. That makes me happy as a baseball prognosticator and not necessarily as a, you know, Baltimore Oriolite. I think to properly evaluate Pete being in Baltimore, you have to understand the context, and that context begins all the way back in 2016, 2017, when the Orioles' previous era of competitiveness kind of fades away and fades out. When Mike Elias takes over before the 2019 season, everyone knows this is going to be a lengthy, painful rebuild. That's exactly what happens. But then as the rebuild, you know, reveals itself to be relatively successful with playoff appearances in 23 and 24, they're not spending, right? They're not going out in free agency and adding big money players. The budget is not rising. And now part of that is because during that span, the ownership group was not the current ownership group. It was the Angelos family for much of that tenure, right? And the Angelos family didn't have the desire, willingness, or ability to spend. So then when David Rubenstein takes over, I believe like the second or third richest owner, like this is a B billionaire, right? A B billionaire who just once paid like $30 million for a copy of the Magna Carta. When he takes over, there's a feeling in the fan base like, okay, now the Baltimore Orioles are going to operate like a mid-market team and not a small market team, a team that can play in the deep end of free agency. But over the first, like last offseason, which was the first offseason under Rubenstein, President of Baseball Operations Mike Elias doesn't do that. He doesn't push the chips in. He doesn't spend big money on a long-term deal from a free agent. Now, whether that was because he didn't have the budget to do so or because he didn't want to, like, he was like, oh, I can do it without that. Who could say? So what this represents, what this deal represents, is basically what Orioles fans have been clamoring for a decade since they signed Chris Davis to what was, you know, one of the worst contracts of the 21st century. The last player, as far as I can tell, to be handed an Orioles jersey at a press conference coming off a free agent signing was Mark Trumbo, head of the 2017 season. Okay. It has been a minute. And so I am quite excited to get in my car this afternoon and battle Friday afternoon traffic, get up to Camden Yards and watch Pete Alonso hold up a crisp new number 25 jersey.
Well, and let's just be clear about what you're saying there, that reference, because I think I understood what you mean, but they've signed free agents since then.
Yeah.
But the press conference element of like, this is an event, right? They didn't do that for Tyler O'Neill last year. I think that was just
or Alex Cobb,
right? Or Alex Cobb or some of the guys, the shorter term ones that they've done. Yeah. Even Alex Cobb,
Jose which was a
yeah. Like they've signed some guys, but like, you know, gather the media and let's really celebrate this. They've done those for draft picks, you know,
yeah.
They've done those for Jackson Holiday and for Adley Rutschman and so on and so on. But
Gunnar Henderson, they haven't done it. They haven't had the big day for the entire family free agent signing. And I think that those types of moments are important for an institution, for a franchise, and just show the type of level you're going to be at. And for the Orioles to reel in a player like Alonso, to overpay for him, and we'll kind of get into what I mean by that, but to go beyond the expectation financially, that's how you land free agents, baby. You don't get good players on bargains. I said this to you multiple times since the O's signed Pete. If you overpay for Pete Alonso, what do you get? You get Pete Alonso,
baby. And we had the reporting earlier this week that the Orioles matched the Phillies' offer to Kyle Schwarber of $5,150. And you say, all right, well, but Kyle Schwarber wanted to go back to the Phillies. Now, in this case, it does not sound like if Pete Alonso wanted to go back to the Mets, he would have even remotely an offer anything resembling this. So, you know, he made it a little bit easier for him to make this decision. As we know now, so far, the reporting suggests that the Red Sox and Cubs were the other teams that met with Pete, who did come to the winter meetings, drove over from his home in Tampa and met with them. But we do not have a sense for the
Kings.
Right, right. They did not. I don't even think the Pirates bothered to pretend in this case. They'll have plenty of other opportunities to we tried this winter. What the Red Sox and Cubs offers are, we don't know. So the degree to which the Orioles, you know, blew the competition out of the water is unclear, but I bring up the Schwarber offer because clearly the Orioles were comfortable giving a free agent hitter a lot of money. And it is almost an identical contract. I think now we will have these two nearly identical contracts to compare over the next 5 years is going to be very compelling, right? Because you can make an argument for both. I know our pal Foolish Baseball put out a poll, you know, which hitter do you want for the next 5 years? Very simple. When you have a contract that's this similar, you can kind of ask that question. And I think you can make some interesting arguments for both, right? Pete is younger. I think he's 2 years younger than Schwarber. Pete is a very bad defender, but he is still playing defense. Okay, so what's that worth? Pete Alonso is right-handed. you know? And then the other thing, when you compare both of them, and we can turn this focus back to Pete and what kind of player he is now, is that Pete did just have, by some metrics, his best season. I know he didn't set a career high in home runs, but when you look at some of the underlying metrics and what he was able to do, the average exit velocity, the hard hit rate, the barrel rate, which has always been elite, 96th percentile XWOBA, but for Pete Alonso in 2025 is by far the best mark of his career. And, you know, Schwarber too, when we talked about him, like, even though he's entering his mid-30s, he just had his best season. These are hitters who have hit for a long time and are still finding ways to at least either sustain elite production, or in Pete's case, bounce back from what looked like maybe a troubling trajectory in 2024. Both of these guys change your lineup, because as we get into why I love Pete Alonso, like, the dude is going to be there. He's going to play. He just played 162 games for the second year in a row. Is he a perfect player? Is he giving you all the F4 that you can dream of? Maybe not. But it's just, it's so comforting. As we get into talking about this projected Orioles lineup and why people are excited about it, other than Gunnar Henderson and honestly Taylor Ward, who we can talk about too, now that he's not, you know, the big addition for the Orioles, but like a nice complimentary piece, there are big questions with a lot of these players. And I think that a lot of people that did not watch the Orioles in 2025 because they were a disappointment very quickly did not realize that a lot of these young hitters that we just assumed were all about to become all-stars, some of them have some real questions. There's real talent still here. But with Pete Alonso, sure, that is not a concern. You know, you are paying for 30 homers, 100 RBIs, a 130 OPS plus. That is so valuable. And that's why part of what made Soto so valuable, because the floor of his offensive production is so high. And I think Pete Alonso has that too. And I just think that can't be, I think it's worth it for really any team. That's why I think he fits with more teams than anyone really gave him a chance to go for.
December 8th, 2025, almost basically 2 days before Pete signs, okay, with the Orioles, Carlos Mendoza sits down at the winter meetings, the manager of the Mets, to do his availability. My dumb Tuchus was sitting right there, and the second question that he was asked was, have you had any interaction with Pete in the offseason? How do you feel? How much do you want Pete back? How big of a piece is he? Here's what Mendoza said. I texted a couple of times with him, but obviously giving him space. As far as how much do I want him, of course I want him. We're talking about a guy that, as a manager, his ability to post every day. You don't have to worry about who's playing for a space, who's going to be hitting in the middle of your lineup. You can't beat that. That is, not to sound like an old curmudgeon, that's undervalued in advanced metrics, in advanced statistics, right? Like, I truly believe that. And I think that is part of why the Orioles were so intrigued by Alonso and Schwarber as characters. Because the offensive production is a given. Their ability to be on the field every day is a near certainty. And that is just such a huge boost to a team that still, despite having a ton of talent, has a lot of unknowns. And that is, like you said, Pete Alonso is a good fit really anywhere. If you've listened to the show, you know Jake and Jordan are super high on Pete, probably compared to most people in the industry. As far as Pete, like the character goes, I'm an enormous fan. He is a dork. He is a kind of a goofy goober. But he is such a genuine, like, he is so genuinely excited about being a baseball player for his career. And he pours everything he has into that. Does it come across as traditionally cool? No, not really. But it is endearing, in my opinion. The passion with which he plays the game is how I think we would like to be if we were baseball players, right? Like, if I was doing the home run derby, I would like to think I would take it, you know, that seriously and put that much into it, right? And so being around, like, Pete Alonso is smarter than maybe he appears sometimes. I think he's got a ton of insight about the game. And selfishly, as someone who's going to drive and see him all the time now that I'm living in DC, like, I'm really excited to have Pete Alonso around. This is a star. This is someone that people tune in for. This is someone that you can buy jerseys for. And for a fan base that hasn't gotten to play in that, like, in that game, it's awesome, dude. Like, it's just, it's really, really special.
Yeah, and like, we've also talked about just the Orioles in general and what they were missing. Now, in some respects, over the past year, as I just alluded to, like, some of this is just strictly on the field performance wise, right? Like, there are huge questions about what Adley Rutschman is at this point as a hitter, as a franchise anchor, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Jackson Holliday, it was an encouraging step forward, but he still had a below average, you know, offensive line. Gunnar Henderson is the one you're setting and forget. Okay. Gunnar Henderson, MVP candidate. Great. That's an awesome thing to have. But in terms of just like the room and the clubhouse and like who is going to be like, all right, let's like, I will speak for the team. I understand what it means to be on a good team, to be on a bad team, to be through a lot of stuff. Like Pete Alonso, this is another thing. Pete Alonso's, you know, if you come from Queens, you've seen some shit, man. Like you've been through it. And Pete's been
He has lived many different baseball lives, even though he has been the same player the whole time.
He has been on
different types of Mets teams. He has been the young guy. He has been the vet. He has been terrible. He has, you know, like not he, but the team has been bad and disappointing. He has been on teams that have gone above expectations. And I think he can add a level of professionalism to a team that, you know, if you look up and down this lineup, hasn't been there. Now, does he move that needle at the same extent as Schwarber as far as a force in the room? In my opinion, no. And that's not like a knock on Pete. I just think Schwarber is unique in that regard.
Totally.
But I do think it is an interesting conversation that I'd like to have now. Then we could take a break and just do Mets. But
okay,
like,
that's fine.
Why a hitter? Why a hitter? Mm. Right? Like if you look up and down this lineup and you're like, oh, Holliday drafted, Westberg drafted, Henderson drafted, Rutschman drafted, Beavers, Couser drafted, Basayo signed. Why are they adding a hitter? Why do you think they're adding a hitter?
Well, let's just talk about the position, right? I mean, if you're looking at the depth chart, they do have two first basemen on it, including Ryan Mountcastle, who's been there for a long time, another homegrown guy, and Kobe Mayo, another homegrown guy. But now they've added two hitters from outside the organization. And I think that it's just very, very, very expensive insurance, because they are now learning that when they're all on the top prospect list, you just assume all of them are going to be all-stars. But some of these players are just not going to be good major league players. Some of them are going to be good major league players. Some of them, I think we have a pretty good idea, right? Westberg, I think, has shown enough that like he's good. I don't know if he's great.
Good
but
player.
He's good.
Good player.
But you have enough questions based on whether it's injuries, whether it's just some of their offensive profiles maybe not working out. And there's more guys beyond just what you're seeing in these projected lineups, right? We're talking even about a Heston Kerstad. We're talking about a Kobe Mayo who's now displaced. Mountcastle's a weird one. I assume he's going to be traded. He really doesn't have much of a place on this team. And by the way, you know who else it's talking about? It's talking about Tyler O'Neill, who you just signed last year and was a total disaster, but is in theory going to be on this roster because I don't know how you're going to trade him. So that's another offensive piece that you don't know what you're getting. And that's the thing. You have to raise the floor. The ceiling could still be super high because there's so much talent here, but you have to raise the floor because we saw that the floor was way lower than we thought it was going to be with this team. But then you zoom farther out and you say, okay, well, but listen, this team can still, and this is still true as we talk today, it is still difficult to take this team seriously with the state of its pitching staff. And Mike Elias knows that. And he's continued to say that a priority is pitching. And I'm sure he will say that again later today. Even if they sign Framber Valdez, I still think it's, you know, a below average pitching staff, but we're at least moving in the right direction. How they choose to address the rotation is really going to determine whether this is a watch out for this team or a, oh, hold on a second. Like they're in the mix here at the top of the AL East. Because as things stand right now, I cannot wait to tune in to watch this lineup. But it's hard for me to be like, this is anything other than a fringe wildcard contender with the state of the pitching staff right now. But again, plenty more offseason to go. And as we'll get to the Mets, we know that there's a lot more work to do for other teams beyond the Orioles. this is a and Helsley, like, I love the Helsley signing. So far, like, Mike Elias is earning all kinds of wins in my book. But I just that's if we really talk about, like, how much does this make the Orioles a relevant playoff team? There's still a lot more work to be done on the other side of the ball.
I am going to slightly defend the pitching staff, which was terrible last year.
Please.
Okay.
Yep.
Trevor Rogers was only around for half the season. And when he was around, he was a top five pitcher in the league, which is preposterous. And I don't think he will do that again. Could Trevor Rogers be a top 20 pitcher next year, Jordan? Do you feel, like, comfortable with that assertion?
Could. I mean, yeah, it's a large enough sample that could. He's good. Great. I'll grant you Trevor Rogers will be a good major league starter, which, again, that's something that they desperately need. So, sure.
And then you have these two guys returning from injury with Kyle Bradish and Tyler Wells, where it's, like, enormous question marks. But, like, the last time we saw a healthy Kyle Bradish, he finished fourth in the Cy Young.
The Bradish is the real one. Wells was fine. Wells was useful.
He's a depth guy.
But those are
He's
two like different very starter. Conversations. Yeah. Yeah. But Bradish is a huge, that is one that I do think that people are discounting. Not that he's a guaranteed back to be in the Cy Young mix, but the upside there is I agree that his upside is probably being discounted a little bit. Sure.
And then I believe enough in Cade Povich's talent that I think he is worth a chance to be in a rotation. And in my mind, you can really only justify having Kremer or Wells, right? And so if the Orioles go out and they add one more piece in the rotation, it's not dominant and it could still bottom out and be a disaster, but you can convince yourself that it is fine enough with the lineup that exists. Now, I'm not sure how Mike Elias could watch the World Series. A World Series, in my opinion, defined, I mean, it was defined by a million things, but defined in part by starting pitching, Yamamoto, Blake Snell, Yesavage, Gossman, like, and not say we need at least one no doubt MFer on this team, right? And how he goes about acquiring that player, or if he goes about acquiring that player, really does define the rest of this winter for the Orioles.
Yes. And that's all before you get to a bullpen that was bottom five in basically every category that Ryan Helsley cannot fix on his own, that Felix Bautista is not a character because he had shoulder surgery, at least not to start the season. So that's a whole bunch of other innings that you're going to have to deal with. That it only becomes more Dietrich important Gens. If your rotation is also bad. Okay, Dietrich Gens. All right.
Correct.
Shout out Dietrich Gens. JC Enriquez. That's our guy. But no, I think that that's fair. And I'm sure they are still hard at work with this. But now you've also raised the floor of your offseason, right? Because I think coming into the winter, one of the fears probably with Orioles fans was like, okay, they need to get a pitcher and they might not. That's still in play, or at least at the top of the market, you know. But if they'd come away with just like a couple mid-tier pitchers and no Pete Alonso, you know, now you're probably still getting dunked on going into the season next year. But right now it's like, okay, hey, you know what? Lineup's pretty fun, pretty cool. And we love Pete. All right, let's take a break. Do we want to do Scobo before we do the Mets? I feel like we probably should. All right.
I mean, it's not going to take that long.
Let's wrap.
Scott Boras, no, I know. Scoreboard. Well, Scobo, you know how this works. So, Scott Boras, scoreboard. When we last talked, Jordan, what is Scott Boras' record?
So after his latest round of stand-up comedy and then also the Diaz and Schwarber news breaking during his round of stand-up comedy, Scott Boras' record came to 6 wins, 2 draws, and 9 losses.
He had good a bad winter meetings Corp. before Wednesday morning.
It was a bad winter meetings. It was. Because again, we were not going to double count. We gave him the dub for Dylan Cease, but not for the Dylan Cease press conference. So we said, how would Boras respond Here's our answer. I mean, listen, let's just straight facts here. We wondered if he could get his deal, but it's not just that he got a big deal. It's that the contract that Pete Alonso got, a five-year, $155 million, essentially does, in retrospect, defeat the extension that he rejected. The Mets offered him, you know, before David Stearns, the Mets offered him a seven-year, $158 million contract in 2023. He said, no, I'm Pete Alonso. I hit home runs. I can make more than that. Last year, Pete Alonso and Scott Boras obviously failed to land the large contract they were seeking. Now they do. And with the $30 million he just made in 2025, means that over those same 7 years of the extension that would have been covered had he signed it, Pete Alonso will instead make $205.5 million, well above the $158 he could have accepted in 2023, which makes that some solid agenting and, more importantly, some solid baseballing from Pete Alonso to ensure that he would be worth such a contract from someone in free agency. They did have to wait a year. They did have to be patient. But now he gets to, you know, spend spring training closer to home in Tampa. He gets to go be a superstar for Baltimore. And it's a dub. It's a dub. It's a win for Boras. Straight, very, very simple, which brings his total record to 7-2-9. Congratulations to Pete. Congratulations to Scott Boras on the handsome commission.
I should today at the Pete press conference, should I ask Scott if he wants to come on and do Scobo with us?
Please.
Do you think he knows? No way, right?
Someone.
I think someone at Boras.
One of the people wearing the Boras quarter zip knows. If you're listening, if you're with Boras, let us know. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, we assess the Mets of New York. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. I have a nuclear overreaction. Nobody is going to go to Mets games ever again. Not this year, not next year. The franchise as we know it is dead. We thought it was being saved by Steve Cohen, but by hiring David Stearns, he has crumpled up the New York Mets and he has dunked it into a rubbish bin. The decision, the dual decision, to allow Pete Alonso and Edwin Diaz to skip town, to, like me, leave New York, is unforgivable. It is downright shameful, Jordan. It is a shanda, okay? And if I was a Mets fan, which thank Yahweh, I am not. If I was a Mets fan, I would be fuming. I would be a ball of fury. I would be punching walls and in a bad mood and in a bad way because the trust that David Stearns deserves as an experienced and skilled executive, still exists. I still think he deserves a little bit more time, maybe. But boy, is he digging a hole for himself here from a public relations standpoint. Because Diaz and Alonso are two of the most beloved players in the recent history of this franchise. And it is no difficult for me to see a way for the Mets to win the offseason. Now, if you win the season, no one cares if you won the offseason. But coming off a year that was, what, top five most disappointing season of the 21st century? You signed the biggest free agent ever? And then lose out to the Reds to make the playoffs? After your owner was like, please show up to games. Please come to the park. And then you did. And then they didn't
That's
win.
That's the real problem. Yeah.
Like, yeah. If I'm a Mets fan, let's just say this. People are not buying season tickets. Okay? They're not buying season ticket packages.
Whoever's selling tickets right now, tough gig. I apologize.
Hi, this is Jake with the New York Mets ticket office. Are you interested in renewing your season ticket plan? We have Anderson Severino.
Going to be just, man, whew. Severino, Devin Williams combo is going to be pretty awesome.
We picked up Ji-Hwan Bae on waivers.
All right. So I'll lean in with you here, and then I'm going to do my best to not even defend what they're doing, but more like,
can I
try
press
pause on the crushing them. Yeah.
Let me say, if you listen to the show, you know, I'm like 20% kidding. And I hope that comes across.
But like, you're also not, I mean, this is kind of what I'm saying from the people that are actually rooting for the team. The reaction from people like Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling on television being like, they're not, you know, as much saying that Stearns should be fired or anything, but they're just like, they are in shock. Like, people
Ron Darling described himself as flabbergasted.
Yeah, like people close to the Mets are genuinely stunned about how this has unfolded. Okay, and that is for of all the franchises to follow closely and then be stunned by something that it relates to them should speak to the state of affairs, I would say.
Think about how many things have stunned and flabbergasted Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling in their Mets lives.
Now, all that said, I think the most important point that you really hit on is at the top, more so with how Steve Cohen has talked about this team, with saying, I'd like to win a World Series in the next 3 to 5 years. Now here we are, we're about to enter year 6. Does it feel like they're about to win the World Series? Not really. Come out to the park. We deserve to, you know, we should be packing this place, blah, blah, blah. They do it. They stink, right? But what's really tough to talk about is all the points being like, okay, they just had this really disappointing season. That's why they should do something about it. And I think that David Stearns is evidently seeing the roster and seeing the team and saying, yeah, I am doing something about it. I'm completely changing the vibe, the tone, the core, everything. Now, you could very reasonably point out and be like, well, it wasn't Pete Alonso and Edwin Diaz and honestly even Brandon Nimmo's fault that the Mets sucked in 2024 or 2025. And that's true. I think that that's mostly how I feel. But I also think that the same Mets fans that are very mad right now have also been saying, like, we gotta do something different. This core is not getting it done. Now, that might just mean they all wanted to trade Jeff McNeil. Sure. Or, you know, trade some of the pitchers, or should, you know, fire some coaches and maybe Nimmo, right? But it's what we've been talking about for the last week, that Stearns, these decisions individually are not surprising. They're just not.
No.
That David Stearns would be like, no, I don't want to pay Pete Alonso $30 million when he's 35. I don't want to pay a closer that much. I don't want to have this Brandon Nimmo contract with us. That's all fine. Those are all defensible, reasonable baseball decisions. But the context here is just different. And it's what you describe. It is a hole that you are digging. It is a hole that you are digging from a PR standpoint. And from my perspective, more relevantly, just as we try to analyze the baseball team, I just don't know what the path forward is where I am feeling super jazzed about the Mets. It's there. And they still have the money to do something nuts, whether that's trade for Tarek Skubal and extend him, whether that's, I don't know. Obviously, you're running out of super exciting options this offseason. And so also, it's like, why is David Stearns going to overpay Cody Bellinger? You know?
This is the point I wanted to make. Is like,
yeah.
Do I trust David Stearns in a vacuum to build a competitive roster? Yeah, I do. He's good at his job and he's got a lot of money, right? Like, I think that the Mets infrastructure right now compared to where it was when Stearns got there is way better. The player dev particularly is way better. What they've done with the starting pitching prospects is unbelievable. Carson Benj, outfield prospect, looks like the real deal. Like, he deserves a lot of credit for that. I think the new coaching staff is good and is going to do a good job, whatever. Okay. When you balk at these prices and you pass on these guys, you're reducing the avenues – the potential paths to building a competitive roster in 2026, right? And as you reduce these avenues, you're negotiating against yourself in a way for those players. So like the price for, say, Alex Bregman is probably higher than it was before they passed on Pete Alonso. Because if I'm Scott Boras and I represent Alex Bregman, I know that the Mets today are more desperate than the Mets last week, right? And so if David Stearns thinks he's going to get a reasonable get these players at a reasonable price, I just don't buy that, man. Now, if the argument is forget a bargain, we're willing to pay Alex Bregman whatever he wants, that's the guy we're overpaying for. Cody Bellinger, that's the guy we're overpaying for. I understand it a little bit more. If you truly believe that those players are the direction that you want to go and you're willing to go above and beyond, we can all take some things back when that happens, right? I just think with these players off the board, it is more difficult to envision a Mets offseason that sticks the landing. Again,
but
if they win in 2026, yeah, it doesn't matter, right? If the goal here is that you're like, our big league coaching staff is amazing now and is going to turn Vientos into an all-star and Beatty into an all-star and Mauricio, like, and that happens and you pull that off, I'll eat crow, you know? But I'm just going to take the under on that every single time compared to Pete Alonso, Edwin Diaz, and whoever else is on the free agent market.
Yeah, and it's really just that, like, you, what really this past season did is just a credibility hit, right? Particularly for Stearns with how last offseason went. And so now if you have Steve Cohen going out there, when John Heyman reaches out to Steve Cohen, is like, hey, what's going on? Steve Cohen, who's like not out there tweeting anymore, and he gives this quote, I totally understand the fans' reaction. There's lots of offseason left to put a playoff team on the field. Come on. Like, honestly, I'd rather you stay in hiding than give that kind of like, oh, we're, don't worry, we're going to make the playoffs. Like, make the playoffs. You were talking a big game. I don't know what kind of things you were saying at this Juan Soto press conference last year, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't like, we're going to put together a playoff.
Not two, not three, not four.
Right. You know, it wasn't quite, you know, the Heat, but you're thinking big. How could you not? That's the whole point. And so there is a lot of offseason left. It's true. But I am stuck with, they're going to have to get really creative. And I just, if they are going to overpay, it's not going to be a Stearns idea. It's going to be Steve Cohen getting, you know, upset or impatient, and maybe that you can argue over which is the right way to handle a baseball team. I think this is really where the dynamic becomes so interesting, right? Because at the time when David Stearns gets hired, the premise is beautiful in the same way that we have seen Andrew Friedman flourish with the Dodgers. It's like, if you put this brilliant baseball mind with infinite resources, surely World Series will follow. But now they find themselves in a position where those two, you know, sides are maybe competing, and it seems like David Stearns is winning for better or for worse. And that Steve Cohen and David Stearns, who grew up as Mets fans, have decided this is what's best for the Mets. They might be right.
Yeah.
And we are going to find out, but they are really putting their stamp on it in a way that is compelling. And we're going to see how it works out.
Everything in Mets land has to be and should be evaluated in the context of the Dodgers. And that is Steve Cohen's fault, right? Because he has said that he wants to be Dodgers East in as many words, right? Let's take a look at the Dodgers. Who are the three most important position players on the Dodgers? Will Smith probably belongs, whatever. Shohei Ohtani, how'd they get him?
They threw a bunch of money at him.
Mookie Betts, how'd they get him?
They threw Connor Wong at the Red Sox, and then they threw a bunch of money at him.
Freddie Freeman, how'd they get him?
The Braves really didn't want him for some reason, and then they threw a bunch of money at him.
Tommy Edman, that was a trade and a signing. Teoscar Hernandez, that was a signing. Let's go to the pitchers. Yamamoto, tons of money. Blake Snell, tons of money. Glasnow, trade, tons of money. Ohtani, who I mentioned earlier, actually also pitches. That's a lot of money. Congrats. You developed Emichian. Like, that's a huge win, and that's really important.
Emichian, Will Smith, Max Muncy. But, yeah.
It's a supplement, man. It's a supplement, right? And I think that if it took Andrew Friedman a long time to learn this, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was trying to do it the other way for a while and didn't work. And I just hope that it doesn't take as long for the Mets. And
yeah,
this is a fascinating dynamic that happens sometimes, is where, like, the people running these teams are, like, are really smart. And they're like, oh, I don't need to do it that way, even though I can, you know?
Yeah. No, it's again, it's fascinating. The Mets are always going to be, give us reasons to talk about them. And yeah, it's just a lot on this young wave, right? Like, that's a lot on Carson Bench. That's a lot on Jet Williams. That's a lot on even the young players that we've already seen in the major leagues, let alone the pitchers, who are even more fickle. You know, pitchers you count on even less. You couldn't ask for more from Nolan McLain, but are we really thinking if he's just merely good in 2026 instead of Cy Young candidate, are we going to be shocked? No, because Major League Baseball is really hard. So we will see. I think that they will add at least one significant major leaguer this winter, but either way, it is going to be tough to win back the fans. But Mets fans are Mets fans, which means they will always love the Mets. All right, we have a couple other news and transactions that we did want to hit for Good, Bad, Ugly. So let's do that. Let's go around the league.
For about 48 hours after the New York Mets allowed Edwin Diaz to sign with the Los Angeles Dodgers, the assumption was like, oh, well, they got Devin Williams and they'll just go get Robert Suarez. Excuse me. Well, guess what? They didn't get Robert Suarez. The Mets did not sign Robert Suarez, and that is because the closer, formerly of the San Diego Padres, is off to the Atlanta Braves on a 3-year, $45 million deal. And most compellingly, he's not even going to close for the Braves. He is going to be the setup man for Raisel Iglesias, who came back on a 1-year deal with Atlanta. I think that's super interesting, and I actually kind of love it, because Iglesias is really good, and like, give him the ninth, and then you could just deploy Robert Suarez as the fireman in the seventh or eighth, whenever the top of the other team's lineup is coming up.
Yeah, and it would hardly be surprising if Suarez returns to closing, you know, in the second year of this deal. Iglesias, they're both a little bit older relative to some of the other, you know, top closers in the game. It is a real change. I mean, Robert Suarez has been about of a like, no nonsense ninth inning. You're not messing with that as you can have. I think I looked and he only came in before the ninth inning twice or three times all season in 2025. So this is clearly a change in role for him that he must be comfortable with. But also the Braves might have just given him the easiest offer and he wanted to go play for a team that's supposed to be pretty good. And as we've talked about this, and I know we talked to our colleague Russ Dorsey about this, like, this is an interesting dynamic in the relief market, because some pitchers do care. Some relievers and closers do care. And maybe we were wrong to assume that Robert Suarez cared, because clearly he's like, no, it's fine. Whatever. I'll go be the eighth inning guy. Or, you know, Raisel Iglesias will go back to sucking like he did for the first 2 months of last year, and he'll just lose the job. And now they have a good backup plan. I think the Braves are a team we have definitely not focused enough on. I'm realizing we haven't talked about Mike Yastrzemski is another signing that happened, I guess, since we last spoke. So that's another thing that I guess we could just throw in there conveniently because it's the Braves. But the Braves, like, that's another team. They're in the list of teams that were just catastrophically disappointing last season. Again, you go look at the power rankings going into 2025. They are essentially number two in every single one of, pick your favorite power ranking, they are number two behind the Dodgers. That was the team. It was like, if anyone's going to push the Dodgers, it's going to be the Braves. And it was because of injuries, because of underperformance, because of a lot of things that went wrong. They were nowhere close. And we essentially just forgot about them. We wrote them off. We didn't think about them for the second half of the season whatsoever. And that made sense. But there is still so much talent on this team. There's questions for sure. But we should not be surprised that they are like, no, let's go get some good major leaguers and let's run this back with Walt Weiss instead of Brian Snitker. And let's see if we can get back to the top of the National League. And I thought Yastrzemski was a good sign and kind of a weird fit on the team, but I think he's good. I think Suarez is good. And big week for the Atlanta Braves Foundation, who, you know, racking up the 1% here from their new free agents.
The true 1%. I mean, this is just a sign that Ozuna's not coming back, which I think we probably already knew. What is most interesting to me about the Yastrzemski signing is this. Let me take a step back. Right now, you have four outfielders that you could reasonably start. Michael Harris is going to play center field. Bad offensive season, great out there with the glove, bounce back a little in the second half, like he's going to play center field, right? You're going to have Acuna in right because duh. And then left was going to be Jurickson Profar, but now you also have Mike Yastrzemski. So those are four dudes for three spots. One of them probably moves to DH, probably Profar, maybe Yastrzemski. But then you can't play Sean Murphy and Drake Baldwin at the same time. Two catchers. Murphy still under a lot of money and under contract. Baldwin, reigning rookie of the year. I thought that the Braves were going to use the DH spot to get both of those guys at bats regularly. And so this signing for Yastrzemski means more than just Yastrzemski. Does it precipitate another trade? Maybe. But what it certainly means if that doesn't happen is that there will just be less playing time for both of these dudes moving forward.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And, you know, Stremsky, 2 years, $23 million. You know, it's not, and I think maybe some people might have assumed he was only going to get a 1 year deal because of his age, but like, he's good. He's a good player. And
two war. That kind of offer, two war.
You're getting two war. That's a guarantee. I feel very good about that going into next season as well. So, no, it's a great point. I think the Baldwin Murphy dynamic was already interesting on its own because of how good Baldwin was. And he was really the bat that you needed to get into the lineup. But I think Sean Murphy is still clearly a good starting catcher. And it's hard to imagine. I mean, on one hand, it's like everybody needs catching, but I don't know how much trade value Sean Murphy really has, if we're being real. And then not to mention, like, I have no idea what to make of Profar coming off the PED suspension. You know, I mean, it was a year ago when they signed him. It was like, all right, like, let's see how legit he is. Well, we found out that, you know, maybe not super legit, but he will at least have an opportunity to show it. But yeah.
I mean, he was pretty good, like, when he came back. And so remember,
you know, if I had to guess, like, I don't have his numbers up. How many plate appearances did he get? Like, this is good. Like, I truly have, I'm going to try and guess here. What. Profar
Welcome
did.
To Baseball Barbacast, where Jordan Schusman guesses Jurickson Profar's 2025 season.
Well,
okay,
do the whole thing. I didn't
give me plate appearances, give me homers, and give me OPS plus.
Okay, so he came back. It was 80 games, right? So he came back in July, and I guess he was basically playing every day. So I'll say like 240 plate appearances. That seems high. I'll say 200 plate appearances, and I will say homers. I don't seven and like a 109 OPS plus.
371 plate appearances, 14 home runs, and 121 OPS plus.
121. Okay? Okay. So
Jurickson Profar was good. And when it's like, oh, was what he did real? Guess what? Doesn't matter. The PEDs don't just leave your system, okay? They don't just go away, in my opinion. And so, like, anyway, he's a good hitter, and he's going to be playing. You're right, dude. The Braves are very, very interesting. I wonder if they're going to do something else.
I think so, man. I mean, good team. I like Yaz. I like Robert Torres. Could still use more pitching, I would say. Couple other reliever signings. Mark Leiter to the A's. Mark Leiter Jr. Cubs signed Hobie Milner. So Cubs obviously have a ton of bullpen innings to replace. Hobie Milner will help them do that. Still pretty good. Funky lefty. Mark Leiter Jr. was just on the Yankees the whole season and was not really ever a reliever anyone was talking about. Still gets a lot of swing and miss. The A's need all the pitching help they can get. couple of outfielder signings.
The Yankees non-tendered him.
Yeah.
The Yankees non-tendered him, right? Yeah. I think that's just important to understand is they could have had him for a price, and they didn't, and he made significantly less than that number with the A's. The A's just need human beings that get outs, and I think Mark Leiter Jr. Yep. is a nice upgrade. He is a like a perfectly old-school, gruff, hard reliever type, and I think that will be a good thing for the A's to have around. Royals sign Lane yep. Thomas, whose Guardians tenure is defined by one swing. Besides that one swing, it was a catastrophe, like an utter disaster. The Guardians rarely do this type of thing. The guy that they traded away for him, Alex Clemmy, looks pretty good. And
even
Lane
if he's
Thomas,
a reliever, like I do like Alex Clemmy.
Even if he's a reliever. Yeah. Lane Thomas hit a grand slam off Tarek Skubal and like, great. That's it. He's now in the Royals. Royals are a weird team. Not really sure what they're going to do. There were some Teoscar or Hernandez Royals rumors. Here's what I would say. If you're the Royals.
See that?
Teoscar, you didn't see that?
Oh. How about that?
It was on the old MLB trade rumors. Anyway, all I'm saying is, like, I feel like if Teo went to the Royals, I know he's a pro, but if I'm going from the Dodgers to the Royals, like, I'm not amped about that.
True. The Royals outfield production has been so bad. Again, all of it, right? I know Kyle Isbell plays a good center field, but the Royals offensive production in the outfield is just like shockingly horrible and has been for many years now. So the bar is the floor, and I think they hope that healthy Lane Thomas can help, you know, improve upon that.
Sure. Congrats. The Brewers sign Akil Baddoo. Who is pretty good for the Tigers in AAA and is only 27 and is just like the most, like if Akil Baddoo is like an important piece of the 2026 Brewers, would any of us be surprised?
No. No, we would not. And with that, we will take a break. When we return, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast, a podcast that I really like.
Same. It's one of my Thanks. Favorites.
Let's do the good, the bad, the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing Dan ugly from the week that was. Jordan. What's good for you?
My good is Paul Hoynes winning the BBWAA Career Excellence Award, which I believe has now been renamed the Platinum Pen Award, which is great. For media, just awesome, you know, media wordplay there. Paul Hoynes. Who's Paul Hoynes? Paul Hoynes has been on the Cleveland Guardians beat since 1983. I'm just going to say that again. Paul Hoynes has been on the Cleveland Guardians, of course, Indians for a long time, beat since 1983. He is still a regular in the Cleveland press box. I have been fortunate enough to get to know Paul, known as Hoynesy by most, over the last couple of years since I moved to Northeast Ohio. And watching this dude work and continue to work over four decades into this thing is so amazing and so inspiring, and just his general demeanor and energy is just so welcoming and kind. But like the fact that he's still doing this, you know, the people who get this award, a lot of in recent years, you know, last year Hoynesy was up for this award, and ultimately Tom Boswell of the Washington Post won it, well deserved for sure. But a lot of the people who win this award are their days covering game on a regular basis are long behind them, and yet Hoynesy's still cooking, man. On Wednesday, I go to the Rule 5 draft. Of course, it's one of my favorite events, and you know there's only a few Cleveland writers there, and the Guardians take a guy from the White Sox, Peyton Paulette, who I'm really excited about. He was going to be a top prospect at Arkansas. Then he got hurt, but I was really excited about Peyton Pellett. And so at the Rule 5, most of the time, the people that talk about the pick after the fact are not like the actual GM. It's like, you know, lower level baseball ops people or assistant GM or pro scouting director, whatever. So you kind of just shuffle over and talk to them after the Rule 5 ends. And there Hoynesy's just ready to go, man. He's ready to fire off some questions about Peyton Pellett. And I'm just standing there with him, listening to him ask one of the Guardians front office people about it. And I'm just like, this is unbelievable. Like, this dude's going to Cooperstown in July. You know, like, he's going to get to go give a speech and be a part of the celebration next summer. Well deserved. And I just couldn't be happy for him. Obviously, I know like such a tiny, tiny, minuscule fraction of what he has meant to Cleveland sports writing and just this franchise and everything. But I'm just in awe that he's still doing it and still cooking. And by all accounts, we'll be back on the beat again next year. And I'm just lucky to be a part of it. So congratulations to Hoynesy. What a guy. What a career he has covered. And here's a more of a just like, I mean, I would encourage people to look at the press release on the Hall of Fame website, because it just kind of lists like how many managers he's covered, how many games, how many, all these things. But the like 77-year World Series drought, and he's seen more than half of it. Okay, like, you think about what this town has been through in all sports, but for baseball in particular, covering multiple World Series Game 7 losses, you know, not to mention some other memorable postseason runs. It's just amazing. And as people who are at the earliest stages of being in this industry, it is hard to fathom that someone could do this for this long, this well, and still be like upbeat and have good vibes, because there's a lot of grumpy folks that are a lot closer to our age that are doing this. And he's just still chugging along. So makes me happy. Very good. Congratulations to Hoynesy.
Hoynesy's first year, his rookie year, okay, overlaps with Pete Rose and Joe Morgan. All right.
Yeah.
Still going. it's just
like, there's so many parts about it that are hard to wrap your mind around, but it's awesome. So what a career. Well deserved.
Speaking of great careers that are well deserved, back to Pete Alonso for a second. The New York Mets, upon the official announcement of Alonso's deal with the Baltimore Orioles, dropped some super hot fire on the internet machine with a tribute video for the ages. Everything that I said in the last block about Pete Alonso not being on the Mets anymore and how that sucks, none of that is the fault of the video editing team that put together this thing. Because boy, oh boy, does it freaking slap. Award season is coming up. I know everybody thinks One Battle After Another is taken home, film of the year or whatever, best picture. I would like to nominate the Pete Alonso tribute video, which bangs. I would pay 10 minutes to go to like IMAX and watch this in a theater like 5 times with surround sound and comfy seats and popcorn. It goes so unbelievably hard. The funniest part, of course, is that the biggest swing of Pete's career, the 3-run go-ahead home run off the Brewers last postseason, was off Devin Williams, who is now in the Mets. And so that swing is only shown from a very specific angle.
Yeah.
It does not include
that. No, that's Devin obviously, Williams. Yes. That is very funny. I mean, to me, it's just that, like, the people that made this video understood the assignment and nailed it, but unfortunately the outcome is just making your fans even more sad and mad, and it's just a very odd dynamic. I disagree.
You're close there. It's making your fans more sad. I don't think it's making them more mad. I think that's an important difference in checking in with your feelings. Okay, sadness is not always fury.
No, for sure, but it's just
Mets
like...
Mets fans, does this video absolutely make you mad, or does it make you sad?
No, you're
email
right.
Us, baseballbarbercast.
It's a fair point, but even... okay, fine. I agree. That's a totally fair response. But again, just the fact that like the goal of the video is to make essentially make your fans as sad as possible, or like if you're doing it well, you're making them incredibly emotional is a very odd kind of
funny thing.
Way in for a this way, to go. It's like
in a way, the propaganda should be a compilation of Pete striking out and being terrible at first base. Right. So your fans are like, oh, we don't need that guy.
If they sign Bellinger,
the opposite of,
it's got to be half the highlights are just like incredible defense at multiple positions. Like that's
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is great, man. Man, what a video. All right. More Mets. We have so much Mets. Holy crap. We go to bad.
Too much Mets?
Probably. Eric Chavez used to be the Mets hitting coach and apparently the bench coach too. I don't remember that, but he was, I think, the bench coach for a year. He was on the Mets coaching staff for several years. He is no longer anymore, but he's just taken to Instagram to just dump everything he feels about the Mets all the time for essentially no
good posting reason. Fee Other, for this guy.
Yeah. this one is when we talk about oversharing, this one is really something to behold. He's doing like a Q&A on Instagram and someone asks, why did the Mets fire you? You were the best hitting coach in the game. Now, is the person who is anonymously asking this really believe it, or are they just like putting the bait down? Either way, it worked.
I like to think it's like Brett Beatty asking.
Eric Chavez gives a very honest response. Well, sometimes things just need to happen. Honestly, I contemplated telling Stearns to just fire me midseason to light a fire. Now, that is ugly. But I'm keeping this in bad because he's just responded to all kinds of stuff. He's like backhanded, you know, compliments to Cohen, but then saying he doesn't like Stearns. There's all kinds of stuff that he's just emptying the proverbial mental notebook of his experience with the Mets. At a time where he just knows that people will read it and be like, haha, the Mets. You know, it's not an accident. Just like, what are you doing? Like, what if Eric Chavez wants to work for a baseball team again, I can't imagine this is the best way to go about his business. I guess that would be the best way to say it and why I'm putting it in bad.
I would also say if you felt like this is something that you needed to share, put your face on it.
This right? is the opposite
like,
of that.
Sit down and do an interview.
There's a lot
like
of podcasts.
Instagram story.
There are so many podcasts, not ours, that would welcome you on to just complain about your time on the Mets. Are you saying we would do that, or are you saying that other podcasts wouldn't?
I think that our producers would want us to do that. They'd be like, Eric Chavez, to whine about the 2025 Mets. You guys can't say
even
none
after
of that.
I put him in bad. Yeah. Anyway, that's my bad. What's your bad?
At that Carlos Mendoza press conference I attended the other day, someone asked him whether Juan Soto would DH at all in 2026. And Carlos Mendoza just said he doesn't like DHing. Now,
there's probably
why
a better way to
bad?
Answer that.
Probably. But that's not my beef. My beef is with Juan Soto.
Mm.
Now, Juan Soto, really good. Do I believe this is true that Juan Soto doesn't like DHing? Oh yeah. Absolutely yeah. true.
Why would Well, of like, course it is. Mendoza wouldn't say this into a microphone if it was that's a weird thing to make up about your guy.
Well, yes, but think about how true it must be. In order for him to say it. It's not like he has a small preference, right? I think it's like, I don't do that. Juan Soto, my dude, you now have two options in my book. We are paying you enough money that either you need to go and spend your winter getting competent in the outfield, or you're DHing. Okay? That's what the money's for. You don't like it? Guess what? That's what the money's for. I'm not saying that Juan Soto is a selfish player, a selfish person, or whatever, right? Like, love Juan Soto. He bangs. He's everything the Mets paid for. I get it. I just think this is a crappy answer, not for Mendoza, but like for Soto. If you want to win more baseball games, you need to understand that you're ass defensively, and you either need to get better or you need to go just focus on hitting, right? Am I being too harsh?
Yeah. A little. No, I mean, I do think it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit more on Mendoza, because it's like, there's a way to answer this question that's just like, you know, we'd prefer to keep him in the outfield. We'll keep our options open. Maybe at some point it makes sense to give him a day, some days at DH.
No, then I want not talking the truth. About this.
I appreciate the truth for sure. And I think this is the truth.
He was the worst. Worst defender in the entire sport. He was worse than Nick Castellanos. Okay?
I think
he sucks last year, out there.
Right. So, but you're 27, you can go get better at it. Or listen, you don't have to go become a Gold Glover. Although Juan Soto has Gold Glove finalist, has been the case, which maybe enabled him to think like, how bad could I be? What's the problem? Bad. I'm doing fine out there. Pretty bad. All right, let's finish up with Ugla. My Ugla is a follow-up to our discussion earlier this week in relation to our experience watching Steven Nogosek, another Met, more Mets. Former Met Steven Nogosek pitched 5 days in a row in the Dominican Winter League. And we were like, there's no way that's ever happened, right? Well, Jake, I've done some research. And by done some research means I did a little bit of Googling and found this article from David Schoenfield of ESPN from 2014. Titled Pitching 4 Days in a Row, a History. Jonathan Papelbon threw 4 days in a row. Again, four, not five. In 2014. And that prompted David to do some research into this. And we have some answers. And he did find that back in the day, four in a row did happen a good amount with the top relievers in the game. But he also found a couple instances of five. In fact, Raleigh Fingers, Bruce Sutter, and Lee Smith at times went 6 days in a row. Okay? So that it has happened. However, most notably, the record, according to David Schoenfield, which certainly has not been broken since 2014 and will certainly never be broken again. Do you want to know what the record is for most days in a row pitched? You have a guess?
Eight?
It is nine.
Wow.
But I bet you can guess who it is, or at least the category of someone that it is. And that
is like old Haas Radborn?
No. It is someone that throws down here. So Tyler Rogers, maybe you can do it someday. It is Kent Tekulve, D3 legend. No, Saberhagen's listed on here. Or no Saberhagen, on at least on this article. Kent Tekulve. Who in 1987 pitched 9 days in a row for the Phillies at age 40, I believe. he, of course, is the owner of, I think, three of the seven highest single season appearances. You know, Mike Marshall's the only one to pitch over 100 games in a single season, but I believe Tekulve did more than 80 or more than 90, I think, three times. So that is your answer. So I don't think we'll ever see that again. And that was, of course, the sidearm or submarine or however you want to call him. The pride of Marietta College. Unbelievable. But Kent Tekulve, man, that is your answer. 9 days. 9 days in a row.
Ugla. You good today? You good?
You feel good? Ugla. I'm good. I'm good.
You feeling all right?
I got it. Put me in, coach.
You good to go? All right. My Ugla is both the BREF, the Baseball Reference Year in Review, and the Fangraphs Year in Review. Jordan, let's actually start with the Fangraphs Year in Review. One of the things I loved about the Fangraphs Year in Review is that you could just see how much of an addict you are.
Where it's that's the like whole point of these things, right?
But it's literally like you ranked at this number of most people in the world visiting the site. George Schusterman, you beat me this year.
I sure did.
Where did you rank in the most views on Fangraphs?
I'm actually disappointed because there are definitely situations where I haven't been logged in. and that's what requires, of course, it to track you. That said, 276th, 99th percentile. What about you?
651, 98th percentile, but I have more hobbies.
Congratulations. You win. Baseball Reference, though, this is not as personalized. This is something we've talked about on the podcast in the past. The Baseball Reference Season in Review gives you the most viewed player pages by state. Most viewed player pages, you know, what day did everyone rush to see one player page? What stands out from the BREF review? Because I already tweeted about one of them, but I don't know if there was anything else you want to highlight.
What you tweeted about is easily the funniest thing. It is most viewed pages on a single day. Number one is Ricky Henderson passing away, his page. Number two is Juan Soto signing with the Mets, his page. And number three is Ryan McMahon getting traded to the Yankees, because all these Yankee fans who have like barely ever seen Ryan McMahon play because he's on the Rockies are like, Ryan McMahon, is he good? Right? They didn't have to do this with David Bednar or Camilo Duvall or Jose Caballero because they were either familiar or they were like, that guy's a reliever. But the Yankees' third base situation was so dire and so awful for the first half of the season. They're like, is this guy really going to save us? The answer is not really.
Not really. It was also the first trade, right? Or one of the first trades. It was the first move that they made. So, but it was, the circumstances are just perfect. Like, it's just so funny.
Now, if you like the map.
Anything else stand out?
If you like the map.
Yeah, the maps are always great.
Yeah. Map is most viewed player by state. There are only five players represented as the most in a state. This might shock you. It's a lot of Aaron Judge, and it's a lot of Shohei Ohtani. Cal Raleigh won. I always like to think about this as a electoral college map. Cal Raleigh took home the, 10 votes from Washington.
How many does Washington have? I don't even know if it's that many.
Electoral college map. Come on, Jake. 12.
Well, tell me.
More
than
them.
Okay. Well, tell me how many does Wisconsin and Kansas have? Because Bobby Witt Jr. managed to take home Kansas, not Missouri.
Six.
But he did manage to take home Kansas. And Christian Yelich still holding it down in Wisconsin. So can't believe Caleb Durbin was not number one there. That's a little bit disappointing. Ohtani takes Alaska and Hawaii. Judge. How do we feel about Judge? Like Judge does have a good amount of like the plains. And like him taking Arizona America is honestly kind of impressive, you know. Ohtani's I like that Minnesota is the farthest east that Ohtani won.
Yep.
Whereas Arizona and Nevada was the farthest west that Aaron Judge won. But Judge, everything east of the Mississippi, Aaron Judge, I guess Yelich. But yeah, Aaron Judge, take it away.
Can you do me a favor, Jordan? Can you wrap up and vamp for like 2 minutes while I calculate the electoral college of this map between Judge and Ohtani?
Sure. So I'll just give some other observations on the team pages. You know, one of the cool things about the team page map is it's almost a de facto map of like what the territory is for the fans, right? So you see that the Astros, the highest, most viewed team page in Louisiana is Houston. Okay, that makes sense. But then you see that the most viewed team page in Arkansas is the Cubs. It's like, okay, well, is Arkansas Cubs territory? I would have thought that maybe that would have been even still the Braves or maybe the Cardinals, who have the most viewed in Oklahoma and Missouri. You see Iowa as the Cubs. And so that always kind of interests me. I'm compelled by, I think, maybe the most interesting single team on here for the most viewed team pages by state. I think it's the Giants. The Giants, of course, not taking home their home state of California, but Wyoming, very interestingly, was the most viewed team page by the Giants, was number one in Wyoming. I'm trying to think about why that would be, and nothing
Brandon Nimmo trade rumors?
Yeah, maybe. I'm struggling with that one. I can't quite piece that one together. But I also think that, you know what I also think is kind of reflective? I think that the Yankees having North Carolina and South Carolina, I feel like the Braves normally have that under control. But this year was, I think it started to slip. Florida too is less surprising that that goes to the Yankees. But I think that kind of showed the kind of season that the Braves had, because Braves country usually covers the Carolinas and sometimes even up to Kentucky. But Kentucky goes to the Reds. Tennessee stays with the Braves. And then New England is also always a little bit interesting to see, you know, does it looks like the Red Sox took Connecticut, which is a nice win for them. But, you know, for the most part, there isn't anything too shocking. But yeah, Giants in Wyoming, I would love to hear some theories about. That would really be appreciated. And then Cubs in New Mexico is another one that is interesting. All right, you got some results?
I have some results. The votes are in. Key race alert.
All right, CNN's Ohtani. John King. Let me know what we got.
Come on, dude. Jake Mintz Tapper logging on. With Washington, Kansas, and Wisconsin still outstanding,
aka Cal Raleigh, Bobby Witt, Christian Yelich,
Aaron Judge, the Republican nominee, in a landslide victory, 370 Electoral College votes, while Shohei Ohtani, despite not being born in America, eligible.
Yes. I demand a recount. This is still not convincing enough. We need to give. I would honestly, you know, like, I understand why they're doing this. I would love to just know the third most in every state. If we assume that Ohtani and Judge are one and two in essentially every state, it would be nice if they could tell us the third most in every state, because that would be actually more illustrative, I think.
I agree.
Just a suggestion.
All right, that's our
show. Sean Foreman. Anyway, check it out. Baseball reference season in review. Thank you all for listening. Everyone have a good weekend. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with two more shows on Tuesday and Friday. We'll talk a little bit about the World Baseball Classic. A lot of news and notes coming out of that in terms of who's playing, who's not, stuff like that. So we'll get to that next week. And I have a feeling we will have at least one more major transaction to talk about when we reconvene on Tuesday. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Angel Rosas for producing. Goodbye.